So it's the second week of work, rest, play. Last week, if you remember, and if you don't remember, you can watch it on the podcast afterwards, but we talked a little bit about holiness and how actually our tendency within contemporary life is to compartmentalize everything. So we sort of group things into little compartments and that's where they stay. And holiness is one of these things that we do that to because of our belief that maybe holiness is really fragile and therefore we've got to kind of protect it. And this means that what happens is we think about our work life and our rest life and our play life, we think about them quite differently and we think about them almost detached from one another and all three of them detached from what it is to be the people of God, what it is to be Christians. And so when we talked about that a little bit last week, the attempt was to sort of work out how it is that maybe holiness isn't so fragile. Instead, holiness is looking to kind of seep out from us in all of these categories of our life, our work, our rest, and our play. And part of the logic for this in a verse that I just hope is the verse that you're beginning to wake up in the middle of the night and think, I'm quite intentionally just making it the verse for every sermon. Maybe you've noticed that. And there are other verses in the Bible. I do know this. But Jeremiah 29, verse 7, seek the shalom of the city. Seek. There's an active sort of sense to that. Seek the wholeness, the peace, the prosperity, the completeness. That's what shalom sort of means. Seek the wholeness of the city where I have sent you into exile. This is what the Lord is saying to God's people back in Jeremiah's time. Pray to the Lord on the city's behalf, for in its wholeness you will find your wholeness. So if we're going to think about our holiness and our wholeness as something compartmentalized, well, even if you think about that, how could wholeness be something we just keep in one particular category? You know, you would rarely say, you know what, my friend Jack, like, you know, his work life is a mess and he's just a workaholic and his family life's chaotic and he's got no hobbies. You know, but when it comes to faith, man, he's just so centered. Like, you know, you wouldn't say that. You would generally see that all of the areas of our life start to leak into each other. And this is exactly what it seems to be that God's calling us to here, that somehow if we live out our wholeness in the environment that he's called us to, that's how we pursue finding wholeness ourselves. However, thinking about that then, I feel like there's a bigger story to engage with. And it's a story that we've rehearsed before at Westside. But I think it's worth us sort of just returning to certain stories. And I think to understand a little bit about where the Bible locates us as people who work, you have to start somewhere. Fortunately, the place that I think you need to start is the beginning. And the very first words of the Bible are, in the beginning, which is really helpful to know that you're at the start when it sort of begins like that. In the beginning, the Bible tells us that there's this creation narrative. And it's a creation narrative. Actually, if you read it in Hebrew, it's more of a poem. And it sort of works like a piece of poetry almost, where you get this rhythm to it. And what happens is God makes things, and then things are made in one particular day, and God looks at those things and he says, these things are good. And then he makes something else on the next day, and that too is good. And this sequence kind of continues through day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then on the seventh day, God makes this notion of rest. This idea that you would have a day where you don't create. And for Jewish people, this rhythm is the rhythm of the world, that the world kind of works its way in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then breathe out and rest. And then it starts again. It's fascinating to me that in the Western world, how often we try and live out of sync with that rhythm. So we will talk about things which we see as almost sort of sacrosanct in Western society. Like, you got to have a plan for retirement because you need to rest when you hit that point in your life. And you got to make sure you get a good vacation in your career and your job, because your vacation, it's important to get that rest. But very rarely do you hear people say, also, you should really take a day off every week wherein you don't create something. A day where you do kind of nothing. And people go, whoa, 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 no, don't do that religious stuff to me. Like, that's for weirdos and things. Because for many of us, our six-day pattern, when we get to our seventh rest day, for many of us, we do more on our rest day. How many of you wake up in the morning of your day off and there is a list of things that you need to do on that particular day, a list of things that you need to achieve. In fact, for many people, Monday is a great day to go back and kind of catch up from the weekend that went before, right? And we kind of leave out of sync, and we think about holidays, and we think about retirement as important rest features, but something as basic and simple as, you know, is there a day during the week where nobody can get you on the phone? That sort of doesn't happen for us. But this is the story where the Bible begins, and it sets out a kind of pattern for us. Now, what's also interesting in this origin story is that actually the Bible doesn't talk about this six-day creation in the same way that often people do in church. So perhaps you, like me, have heard some sermons on this in your time. And people say, oh, and God made creation, and he made the light and darkness, and he made animals and trees, and he made sea and mountains, and then he made humans, and he placed them in the middle of this garden called Eden. And people often then say, and it was perfect, despite the fact that the Bible never says it was perfect. Nowhere in the whole creation story is it ever described as perfect. Instead, all that God ever says about it is that it was good. Now you say, well, you know, what's the difference? Like, surely if God makes something and we say that's good, that's going to be perfect, right? If, you know, if you go to God's house for, you know, pie, you know, and he says the pie is good, you're going to imagine the pie. I don't know. I just have this thing that I imagine God would serve pie because, well, because he's God, and is there a finer food? And so, you know, if God said the pie is good, you would imagine the pie is going to be like really good. Like, this is going to be the best pie ever. So we kind of get into this mindset of if God made the world good, that means perfect. Except that that's not quite how the story tells it. See, because the story says that it's good, and then in chapter 2 of Genesis, it says the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. Now, a perfect garden, in my mind, wouldn't need work, and it definitely wouldn't need me to take care of it. But somewhere in this story of beginnings, this garden, it requires work. This is a perfect garden, we would say. No, God doesn't say that. He says it's a good garden. But the Garden of Eden, in the story, in the narrative of Jewish origins, they see in it, when kind of rabbis read the story, they realize that somehow in God's creative splendor is this sense that this good space is designed to grow. This good space has something of potential within it. In a quote that you've encountered before, you know, Albert Walter says, the earth had been completely unformed and empty. In the six-day process of development, God had formed it and filled it, but not completely. People must now carry on the work of development. By being fruitful, they fill it even more. By subduing it, they form it even more. As God's representatives, we carry on where God left off. But this is now to be a human development of the earth. The human race will fill the earth with its own kind, and it will form the earth for its own kind. And from now on, the development of the created earth will be societal and cultural in nature. You see, the garden wasn't perfect. It was designed to grow. Humans were placed in this garden as part of this narrative to help us understand that work is at the core of God's dream of creation, that we do things with our time. Now, it's quite important that the whole story is designed to grow, because here at the beginning of the story, we have this book which literally is called The Beginning, and it tells us how everything started. Now, if you go to the end of the Bible, you find another book, and this book is ironically called Revelation. I say ironically because most people read Revelation and don't feel like anything is made any clearer by this book that is supposed to reveal things. Revelation is much loved by people that make Christian television programs and write bad Christian novels. Most Christians find Revelation terrifying to read because it just feels really scary. There's like fights and wars and beasts with three heads and horses that seem also to be sheep and all sorts of terrifying stuff. You kind of like have never seen horror movies like as the same as what you see when you get to Revelation. When I was a kid, you know, everybody was into the Left Behind movies. I don't know if anybody saw them. I mean, Nicolas Cage is a bad actor at the best of times, but give him a bad script and it just gets even worse. And And then if you really go back in Christian history, there was a series of movies called A Thief in the Night and A Distant Thunder. And there's a whole generation of Christian children never slept because their parents showed them that show, because they kind of present God as this kind of terrifying character. And so we kind of avoid reading Revelation because we don't really understand it. And I'm not really supposed to be talking about Revelation this morning, but do you want me to give you like a kind of sentence on what Revelation's actually doing? Would that be helpful? Okay, so Revelation in one sentence. Let me just give me a little bit of preamble in order to help that. Revelation as a piece of literature is known as apocalyptic. Apocalyptic is a genre of writing that was really common in around the time of Jesus and prior to that, that you'll find bits of it in bits of the Old Testament, Daniel chapter 13 and stuff like that. You'll start to feel kind of apocalyptic styles of writing. And it was a way of kind of codifying your language. So you would write about really terrifying sounding big things, and it was a way of sort of hiding truth within it. Now, it's hard for us as Western people to often read it because we kind of read it and just get kind of blasted by all of the visual imagery. But if you kind of grew up in a culture that read a lot of apocalyptic literature, you would kind of know what to do with it. Kind of like you do when you sit down to watch a movie. You sit down to watch a movie and you instantly start to make genre assessments when you're watching the movie. You don't know that you do this because somewhere along the line we just picked it up. But is this a true story? Is this not a true story? What kind of genre of film is this? So that I kind of know what to expect when I watch the movie. You all do this kind of really naturally and easily. And as a result, you kind of can watch movies and listen to stories and enjoy them, right? Apocalyptic is a way of writing that takes sort of really kind of simple truths of things and kind of hides them in big language. Sometimes some scholars think you do this in order to make sure that if you're in exile or if you're surrounded by people that aren't favorable towards your religion, it's a way of kind of just hiding the truth. So when you read Revelation, bear in mind you're reading a genre that we don't use anymore, okay? So Revelation in one sentence. Revelation in one sentence, hidden behind all of this apocalyptic language, is essentially trying to just tell you one thing. And this is it. Everything's going to be okay. Because Jesus is king. And that's essentially it. Revelation is a way of writing that sort of says, hey, listen, it's all going to be a little scary at times, and you're going to see that, and you're going to feel threats, and it's often going to feel like this is never going to happen, and it feels like God's totally out of control. But even if the whole world looks like it's telling a different story, Revelation is making the point that Jesus is king, and everything will be okay when God acts. Now, you can get behind that, right? And you're going to forget that a lot of times and read Revelation and think it's really, really scary. But actually, if you find that sort of truth, you'll notice how often that's what's going on in this particular book. Now, what's fascinating, of course, about the book is how it ends, right? So in the first two chapters of the Bible, we have a garden, and the garden is good, and humans are in it, and they're called to work it. And in the final chapter of the Bible, we start to see what the future looks like once God proves to us that everything is going to be okay. And what do you see in Revelation chapter 21? You see a city. The Bible says there's a city, and we see this new city, and in this city is peace and wholeness. Isaiah, when he prophesies in the Old Testament, he talks about this city as a place where there's no violence and there's no war and there's no need for enmity between one another, and the lion lies down with the lamb is the sort of visual language that Isaiah uses about it. This incredible hope for a city that has put all things back together again. Now, for me, what's interesting about this, of course, is if you start with a garden and you take that garden and are called to make it grow, if that garden is designed to develop and become something, if you're asked to work it, what fascinates me is what will happen to any garden if you really commit to that is it will become a city. All gardens will eventually become cities. Calgary is one of the easiest cities in the world to say that to, because there's some of you in this room that remember when the place where we are right now was just a field. Because cities grow. But where do they grow? They grow from gardens. They grow from just being cared for and people committing to work in them. So God puts two people in a garden and he says, make it grow, work at it. And then we follow the whole story through and we end up with a city in the future. Of course, you kind of know that the story's not as simple as that, right? Because we've got two chapters at the beginning of the story where everything's going great. But one of the things that God does in this narrative, which is fascinating, is he gives the humans in the story a choice. Because God's always giving a choice. The fascinating thing about God is he never imposes himself on us. He never kind of demands things of us. He just allows them to choose. And when these humans find themselves in a story and they've got a narrative, and the narrative is care for this garden, work this garden, let it multiply, let it be fruitful. They do all of these things, but they don't quite find themselves satisfied with that because they want something else. One way to talk about it is to say that what the humans wanted in this story is they wanted control of the story. The Bible phrases it like this: they wanted to be like God. So rather than being people as part of the story, they try to narrate the story themselves. This has huge impact. And oftentimes what we do when we talk about the destruction of this story, when we talk about how the story of Genesis falls apart, often how we frame that is we talk about the breakdown of our relationship with God. We talk about how humanity becomes fractured from God. But what we often miss is this story also points out the fracturing of humanity within creation. So in chapter 3 of Genesis, it's just so depressing to say that, chapter 3. God made the world in chapter 1, he put humans in it in chapter 2, and by chapter 3 they broke it. You know, humans are like that roommate that you had in college. You know what I mean? Just no matter what you do, you come home, it's like, oh, sorry, I broke all your stuff. You know, it's just, humans have managed to break the whole thing within half a chapter. And we start to see this sort of follow-on of what happens when they start to control the narrative themselves. In Genesis 3:17, it simply says it like this: cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. So the story falls apart. And the impact of the story falling apart is what the humans were commanded to do by God, which was work this and take care of it, becomes a project that's now difficult. It's no longer easy to work this and take care of it because pain and toil and thorns and thistles enter this story and work becomes hard. The Hebrew phrase that describes this journey is TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. Maybe you've said that at some point in your life. And what you didn't realize when you kind of just expressed this ancient blessing, thank God it's Friday, what you didn't realize is you were rooting yourself in the deep narrative of Scripture, in this narrative of Scripture that says, in painful toil do we go about our work. Because something happens to us where we turn up in our working context and we're just kind of happy to get out of it. Whenever I think about this phrase, there's one name always comes to mind, and the name is Trevor. Trevor is not one of the well-known Hebrew prophets, largely because he's somebody I worked with when I was a teenager. So when I was, I think I was like 17 or 18, let me tell you the story. Honestly, I started dating this girl, and her dad owned a kind of engineering and manufacturing firm. And I was studying software development and programming at that particular point. So I was super practical. And I'm dating this guy's daughter. And it was coming up to summer break. And my suspicion is that he thought, I don't really want this kid hanging around my daughter all summer with nothing to do. So he came to me and said, do you want a job? And now that's the nice side of it. The fact that my first job, he put me out, and what this company used to do is build, you know, those silos where you store grain in these huge store, like tons and tons of grain. And so we turned up on the first day and he said, see that silo there? And I said, yeah. He says, it doesn't have a walkway around it and we're going to build it. And your job on day one is to basically rappel up the side of this silo so you can drill holes so that we can build a walkway there. I'm now suspicious that he was trying to kill me. Initially, I thought, this is great. My girlfriend's dad wants to give me a job, but I think now it was an attempt to assassinate me and ensure that his daughter didn't end up ending up married to me. Now, the story has a happy ending for him because we didn't get married. And So then I find myself, once we kind of done that aspect of the job, he ends up then putting me in their manufacturing plant, which is where you went and actually built the stuff. So my job was super exciting, which was that a forklift truck would bring in steel beams, and I had to kind of line them up on this kind of cutting machine, and then I would push go on the cutting machine, and then I had to watch the cutting machine. I wasn't the cutter, that was the machine's job, and the machine would cut through these beams. It took about half an hour to make each cut because there were huge pieces of metal, and my job was just to basically stand and watch a machine cut a piece of steel for half an hour. It was really exciting. But there was this guy there called Trevor. Trevor was in his mid-50s, and he was a hardened, you know, manufacturer. He'd worked in this sort of industry since he was in his teens. And we used to arrive every single day, and at the beginning of every week, rather, we'd arrive, and we'd be waiting at 8 o'clock in the morning for the plant to open up. And I'd often find myself stood near Trevor, and here's me, this kind of completely out of my depth, in the wrong context, doing a job I don't understand, and all I've learned so far is I don't want to do this for a living. And I'd find myself stood next to Trevor, and I'd always say to Trevor, as a kind of 17, 18-year-old, I'd say to Trevor, hey, you know, how are you, right? And he would always answer with the same response. Every Monday, his response was, I'll be better when it's Friday. Which I always remember thinking, man, that's dark. Like, you know, like I was like, yeah, you know, so anyway, after a little while, and Trevor was kind of scary. He was a welder, and I was always worried that at very least he could blind me easily, if not stick me to stuff. And worst case scenario, I was going to walk at very high heights on stuff he'd welded. So I kind of wanted to keep Trevor in my good books. But one day I felt we'd developed the rapport that I could ask him one Monday, what did you do this weekend, right? Because this guy's whole life from Monday to Friday is about getting to Friday. And Trevor told me that for him, like a really good weekend. I just realized I've got my phone in my pocket here, so that's just in case my mom phones during the service or something. Excuse me. Trevor decided that what a really good weekend for him was a Chinese takeout and watching TV all weekend. I remember an 18-year-old thinking, that's it? So every Monday morning, it's like, I'll be better when it's Friday, and Friday's a Chinese takeout and, you know, and British television? Like, I was fortunate because I grew up with a dad who, you know, I mean, you guys have heard some of his story. You know, we went all around the world doing all sorts of crazy stuff and living in war zones and you know, it strikes me that maybe he was trying to kill me too now I think of it. kind of having this moment of revelation in front of you that everybody I encounter seems to want to kill me. So anyway, we'll deal with that in ghosts next year. So I'm used to living this life, which was kind of exciting. And then I meet this guy and he's like, well, thank God it's Friday because I get to go home and eat takeout food and watch TV all weekend. I'm like, is that all it is? And now, like, I lost touch with Trevor when I stopped working there. I don't know where Trevor is in the world now. But I always think to myself, like, how formative he was in my life, because I remember 18, standing next to him welding something one day and thinking to myself, I don't really know what I'm going to do with my life just yet. I'm not sure how it's going to work its way out. But the only thing I know is I don't want to live like that. And I don't want to, and I'm not talking about that in a sense of superiority. I'm not talking about that in a sense of, you know, Trevor made good money and he seemed to be happy with it. But I thought, I can't live, even at 18, I figured, I don't think life is long enough to wish 5 days of every week away. I don't feel like life is long enough for me to just sort of turn up every Monday and go, I'll be okay when it's Friday. Surely God put us on the planet for something more significant than that, for something that's got depth to it about that, for something that's sort of deeper than that. And it strikes me, see, that what happens when this story falls apart is we end up with disordered values about work. In one sense, there's that type. There's the Trevor type of disordered value, where work is something I simply endure for what I'm going to do when I don't work. And many of us at points in our life have probably wasted too much of our life in that sort of context. I've got to do this job because I need the money it produces. Or I've got to do this job because it allows me to do X or Y the rest of the time. but I don't really find the work itself resonates with who it is I feel I'm supposed to be. There's another way, though, of course, that affects us, and this might be more familiar for some of us, and that's not that our work becomes something we do in order to do something else, but actually that our work becomes something that defines us. Our work becomes something that is who we are. So our work is where our value is found. Our work is where our identity is found. So we're not the type of people that go, I'll be glad when I get this work done so I can be somewhere else. We're the type of people that when we are somewhere else, we're just wishing we could be back at work. And work starts to bleed out into all aspects of our life. We're the people that send emails from the beach. We're the type of people that don't talk to our kids because just dealing with this issue at work is way more important. We're the type of people that are always working because our work defines us. The type of people that if we lose our job, it's catastrophic for us. Because, well, where's my identity? If I don't get to do this, who am I? And we start to kind of suck all of our value and sense of that. People like this find retirement one of the most terrifying notions possible, because what would it look like if I wasn't doing these things? David Zal, I think, phrases it well for us. He says, when work becomes the primary arbiter of identity, purpose, worth, and community in our lives, it has ceased to function as employment and begun to function as a religion. Or at least we have made it responsible for providing the very things to which we used to look to God. See, because God put these people in a garden, and he said they were good before he asked them to do anything. See, because what it is that we do as humans, according to the biblical story, is our work is something that comes out of who we are, but it's not who we are. The humans were good before they had a job. They were good before they had careers. They were good before they did anything. See, because the Bible wants to constantly remind us that you are intrinsically good. And the things that you do are profoundly important, but that's not where your identity and value is found. Instead, the Bible tells us that actually your identity is found in who it is that God made you to be, and the fact that you are loved by him. You see this notably in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, and Paul writes to this church in Ephesus, and it's only six chapters. You could probably read it in 20 minutes while you're cooking at dinner this afternoon, and you could read Ephesians and get from start to finish. What's fascinating about Ephesians is in chapter 1, do you know what Paul tells you to do? He writes to a church, and do you know what he tells them to do in chapter 1? It's absolutely nothing. He asks them to do nothing in a whole chapter. So when you get to chapter 2, you know what he tells them to do in chapter 2? Absolutely nothing, right? And then you get to chapter 3, and you know what he tells them to do in chapter 3? Yeah, absolutely nothing, right? And in chapter 4, do you know what he tells them to do in chapter 4? Loads and loads of things, right? But in chapter 1, he tells them who they are in Christ. In chapter 2, he tells them all the things that Christ has done for them. In chapter 3, he describes how, if we really get a grasp of this, how beautiful it is and the way that God works through all of us. It seems as if Paul understands that before you get to talk about what it is that we should do, we first have to understand who we are. And that primary identity is that we're valued and we mean something because God created us and built us. And our attitude to work has to come from that and not the other way round. This struck me quite strongly as I was in a moment of devotion this week watching Netflix. And I know that you imagine I go home and watch Taylor Swift documentaries all the time, so I'm just going to come out and admit to that. I don't know if any of you saw this. It's a fascinating insight into this young lady's life and how she lives in the spotlight. But as I'm watching this, it just struck me as a sort of quintessential example of the sort of things that I think we deal with and talk with in our working life. So I'd love you just to watch a few minutes of some clips of this documentary.
12-year-old Taylor Swift.
Woo! Hey everybody, I'm Taylor.
I've been trained to be happy when you get a lot of praise. I had that praise of, Taylor, you're doing a good job at your work. You're doing a good job at being a songwriter. You're doing a good job at being a musician. Like, those pats on the head were all I lived for.
Hi.
Good morning.
I've just been, like, running up and downstairs, like, moving things around and packing boxes, like... trying not to think about you calling me with Grammy nominations.
I know. Well, I'm trying to get the full list, because right now, in the big categories of album, record, song, you are not nominated.
Okay, this is good. This is fine.
Yeah. And it's very similar. Everything is like this crumb. You know, it's so weird. I said cast.
This is, you know what? Like, this is fine. This is, yeah. I just need to make a better record. But when you're living for the approval of strangers, and that is where you derive all of your joy and fulfillment, one bad thing can cause everything to crumble.
And the Moon Man for Best Female Video goes to Taylor Swift.
Thank you so much. I always dreamed about what it would be like to maybe win one of these someday, but I never actually thought that would happen.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time.
It was so echoey in there. At the time, I didn't know they were booing him doing that. I thought that they were booing me. For someone who's built their whole belief system on getting people to clap for you, the whole crowd booing is a pretty formative experience.
You can feel it, right? You know, here's this person and their work, what they do, has become so bound up in their identity. And the rest of the film, kind of, you see her wrestle through that. But in those few clips, I felt from you exactly what I felt when I watched it the first time myself. When she stood on that stage, she's 19 years old, by the way, at that point that this is happening. And she stood on that stage and Kanye comes up and reveals to the world that he is nuts. And in all categories, and and she's like a 19-year-old girl, and I heard it from you when she said, and I thought they were booing me, you know, and we can feel the pain and the agony of that, and that's a pop star, and it's easy for us to pick on pop stars, and I hope it doesn't sound like that's what I'm doing this morning, but how many of us live the same story, where what we do is so intrinsically bound up in who we are, and our identity is kind of impossible to disconnect from that, and we live with this voice in our head all the time. You know, that moment when she sat on her sofa and she's waiting for the Grammy nominations to come in, did you see her response to the not being nominated? I'll just do better. Like, I gotta find a way to be better. And we're constantly pushing out, but the drive to be better isn't coming because, hey, God made a garden and he's asked us to work it until it becomes a city. The drive to be better is coming from, because if I'm not, who am I? And when that's your mindset and that your worldview, and then somebody comes up and says, hey, by the way, you see that person over there? They're better than you. Like, this is so destructive. I was halfway up a mountain yesterday and a guy was running down and my buddy turned to me that we were going up the mountain with, and he said, welcome to Canmore. He said, where there's always somebody fitter and faster than you. But isn't that true of life? There's always somebody younger. There's always somebody that's been promoted above you. There's always somebody smarter. There's always somebody better. There's always somebody richer. And yet, we find ourselves so often still trying to find who we are in the things that we do. And this voice in our ear all the time saying, well, you could just be better, or if you could just do better than you currently are. I think if Paul was here from the Bible, he would tell us that voice is the law. The law says you're not good enough. The law says you can't make it. The law says it's just not going to work out properly for you. The beautiful thing is what happens in the gospel is we don't find law, we find grace. And in one of Paul's most beautiful pieces of writing in Romans chapter 8, he says to the people in Rome, he says, "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of the sin and of death." You see, Jesus never walks onto the stage of your life and says, "See that person over there? They're better than you." Jesus never walks onto the stage of your life and says, "I'm sorry there's no nominations, but if you just try harder, maybe I'll like you a little more next year." You don't get that voice of condemnation. Instead, you get what we find in Ephesians, chapter after chapter, that tells you that your value was given to you before you did anything, and what you do doesn't change that. So how we work then is impacted and affected by this thing we call grace, this unmerited graciousness of God that's poured out upon us. Jesus tells a parable one day, because Jesus loved to tell parables. You know that by now, don't you? And he tells a parable about a boss, and the boss had some work that needed to be due. Yeah, because the boss was great at spoken English. And to be due, it sounds like some sort of kids cartoon. If I was quicker, I would turn it into a song right now, but let's not do that. This boss comes along, and he comes to this group of people, and he says to them, "Hey, do you want to work in my field for the day? The salary for a day's work in my field is a day's salary." And the people say, "That sounds good." So they come and work with him in that field. As the day goes on, the boss realizes that the work is perhaps bigger than these group of people can do, so he goes back to the place that you pick up people who would work. And he gets another group of people around about lunchtime, and he says to them, "Would you like to come and work in my field for a day's salary?" And they, of course, say, "Yeah, we'd love that." So they come and work in his field. And then as the day is getting towards the close, he realizes still there is work to be done, because we're trying to build a city here, right? And so he goes back, and with a few hours of working time that's left, he asks another group of people, he says, "Would you come and work in my field for a day's salary?" And they, of course, come. Now, the day gets to its end, and it's time for the boss to pay the people who have worked with him. And Jesus says the boss does something different, you see, because he doesn't come to the people that he hired first and pay them, and not even the people that are second, but Jesus comes to the people that he'd hired. Jesus says the boss comes to the people he'd hired last, and he pays them first. Something about Jesus and last being first that might just spark your interest there. And he pays them their salary, and they get a day's salary for what was like an hour's work. So that looks amazing to these people over here, because surely if they're getting a day's salary for what was an hour's work, how much are we going to get? But you know where this story goes, right? Because these people here find themselves, although they worked half a day, they get also a day's salary. And then over here, we come to these people, and they work the whole day, and they get a day's salary. So everybody got one day's salary at the end of the day. Now, as you can imagine, the people are super excited about this. Well, these people here, they're super excited about it, but these guys here, they're a little mad, right? Because they feel like they've been harsh done to. Even though that's what they agreed to and that's what they needed, they still feel hard done to. There's a beautiful line in it where the boss, who is kind of clearly Jesus in the story, he says to them, like, "Are you just mad at me because I'm generous? Or is there something deeper going on here? Is it perhaps that they're assigning their value from something other than work?" You see, because this parable annoys us in the Western world. We get a little stressed out when we tell this parable. Most pastors are told, "Don't preach this in your church," because people hear this sort of parable, and they say, "Goodness, it sounds like Jesus is promoting socialism." And that can't be right, surely. So what happens is we just don't read the story, but because we get a little kind of turned over about how this salary thing works, and we miss what seems to be the deeper truth within the story, that Jesus is kind of pointing out to these people that they're attaching the wrong value to the wrong things, that they're attaching their value to how much they're paid rather than the fact that they get to work. That they get to work out in this incredible kingdom. And so often this is what happens with our attitude to these things, that we attach the wrong value to the wrong places. But grace makes a strange boss. So we start with a garden. We end with a city. And the city is going to be built not on us tying up our identity in what it is that we do, not in us tying up our identity in how it is that we play or what hobbies we're part of, But if we understand that God's called us to be a people of grace and wholeness, or grace and peace, or shalom. And it's our understanding of grace that moves us from the garden over to the city. It's our understanding that we're not going to get from the garden to the city if we get ourselves all tangled up and caught up in weird identities rooted in what it is that we do. But the way to get from a garden to the city is to understand that you are loved and your value is found in Jesus and not in anything else. And that now frees you to put your hand to what it is that you would want to put your hand to. That you work out not what gets you the best status in your world and not what gets you the best appreciation in your street and not what gets you the most honor in the workplace, but actually a question of what is it that you're meant to be? What is it that you want to be? What is it that's in your heart? Because you see, the wholeness that we'll bring to the world as God's people isn't found in being miserable people that pray for Friday, but rather in people that have found our center in God. And whatever we do, as Colossians says, we work it out for God. Because we, God's people, we live between a garden and a city. And the city's coming because Revelation reminds us that everything will be okay, because that's how God works, right? The city is coming, and we can be part of this story where we find wholeness and truth, or we can fight it and try and find our wholeness in what it is that we do. But the Bible seems to constantly want to remind us that that will always fall short, and the voice in your head will always be a terrifying one. So I simply want to ask this as a blessing over you this morning. May you trust Jesus that unlike your boss or your job or your career or the size of your house or the car that you drive, unlike all of those things, with Jesus and his grace, what you'll find is no condemnation. So may you find that to be true. And in doing so, live free to work out what it is that God has put in your heart so that we can turn this garden into an incredible city. And may his grace and peace be with you.